CD6.
The Shear Zone, Wednesday, October 6th, 12:09 p.m.
The Shear Zone, Jimmy Bolden said, as they trudged toward the vehicle shed. There's nothing to it. You just have to be careful, that's all.
But what is it? Sarah said.
It's a zone where the ice is subjected to lateral forces, shear forces. A bit like the land in California. But instead of having earthquakes, you get crevasses. Lots of them. Deep ones.
We have to cross that?
It's not a problem, Bolden said. 2 years ago, they built a road that crosses the zone safely. They filled in all the crevasses along the road.
They went into the corrugated steel shed. Evans saw a row of boxy vehicles with red cabs and tractor treads.
These are the snow tracks, Bolden said. You and Sarah will go in one, Dr. Kenner in one, and I'll be in the third, leading you.
Why can't we all go in one?
Standard precaution. Keep the weight down. You don't want your vehicle to fall through into a crevasse.
I thought you said there was a road where the crevasses were filled in.
There is. But the road is on an ice field, and the ice moves a couple of inches a day, which means the road moves. Don't worry, it's clearly marked with flags.
Bolden climbed up onto the tread.
Here, let me show you the features of the snow track. You drive it like a regular car. Clutch there, handbrake, accelerator, steering wheel. You run your heater on this switch here.
He pointed to a switch.
You keep it on at all times. It will maintain the cab at around 10 above zero. This bulgy orange beacon on the dashboard is your transponder. It turns on when you push this button here. It also turns on automatically if the vehicle shifts more than 30 degrees from horizontal.
You mean if we fall into a crevasse? Sarah said.
Trust me, that's not going to happen, Bolden said. I'm just showing you the features. Transponder broadcasts a unique vehicle code, so we can come and find you. If for any reason you need to be rescued, you should know that the average time to rescue is 2 hours. Your food is here, water here, you have enough for 10 days. Medical kit here, including morphine and antibiotics. Fire extinguisher here. Expedition equipment in this box. Crampons, ropes, carabiners, all that. Space blankets here. Equipped with mini heaters. They'll keep you above freezing for a week if you crawl inside them. That's about it. We communicate by radio. Speaker in the cab. Microphone above the windshield. Voice activated. Just talk. Got it?
Got it, Sarah said, climbing up.
Then let's get started. Professor, you clear on everything?
I am, Kenner said, climbing up into the adjacent cab.
Okay, Bolden said. Just remember that whenever you are outside your vehicle, it's going to be 30 below zero. Keep your hands and face covered. Any exposed skin will get frostbite in less than a minute. 5 minutes, and you're in danger of losing anatomy. We don't want you folks going home without all your fingers and toes. Or noses.
Bolden went to the third cab.
We proceed in single file, he said, 3 cab lengths apart. No closer under any circumstances, and no farther. If a storm comes up and visibility drops, we maintain the same distance, but reduce our speed. Got it?
They all nodded.
Then let's go!
At the far end of the shed, a corrugated door rolled up, the icy metal screeching. Bright sunlight outside.
Looks like a beautiful day in the neighborhood, Bolden said.
And with a sputter of diesel exhaust, he drove the first snow track out through the door. It was a bouncing, bone-jolting ride. The ice field that looked so flat and featureless from a distance was surprisingly rugged when experienced up close, with long troughs and steep hillocks. Evans felt like he was in a boat, crashing through choppy seas, except, of course, this sea was frozen, and they were moving slowly through it.
Sarah drove, her hands confident on the wheel. Evans sat in the passenger seat beside her, clutching the dashboard to keep his balance.
How fast are we going?
Looks like about 14 miles an hour.
Evans grunted as they nosed down a short trench, then up again.
We've got 2 hours of this?
That's what he said.
By the way, did you check Kenner's references?
Yes, Evans said in a sulky voice.
Were they made up?
No. Their vehicle was third in the row.
Ahead was Kenner's snow track, following behind Bolden's in the lead.
The radio hissed. Okay, they heard Bolden say over the speaker. We're coming into the shear zone. Maintain your distance and stay within the flags.
Evans could see nothing different. It just looked like more ice field glistening in the sun. But here there were red flags on both sides of the route. The flags were mounted on 6-foot-high posts. As they moved deeper into the field, he looked beyond the road to the openings of crevasses in the ice. They had a deep blue color and seemed to glow.
How deep are they? Evans said.
The deepest we've found is 1 kilometer, Bolden said over the radio. Some of them are 1,000 feet. Most are a few 100 feet or less.
They all have that color?
They do, yes.
But you don't want a closer look.
Despite the dire warnings, they crossed the field in safety, leaving the flags behind. Now they saw to the left a sloping mountain with white clouds.
That's Erebus, Bolden said. It's an active volcano. That's steam coming from the summit. Sometimes it lobs chunks of lava, but never this far out. Mount Terror is inactive. You see it ahead, that little slope.
Evans was disappointed. The name, Mount Terror, had suggested something fearsome to him. Not this gentle hill with a rocky outcrop at the top. If the mountain hadn't been pointed out to him, he might not have noticed it at all.
Why is it called Mount Terror? He said. It's not terrifying. Has nothing to do with that. The first Antarctic landmarks were named after the ships that discovered them, Bolden said. Terror was apparently the name of a ship in the 19th century.
Where's the Brewster camp? Sarah said.
Should be visible any minute now, Bolden said. So, you people are some kind of inspectors?
We're from the IADG, Kenner said, the International Inspection Agency. We're required to make sure that no U.S. research project violates the international agreements on Antarctica.
Uh-huh.
Dr. Brewster showed up so quickly, Kenner went on. He never submitted his research grant proposal for IADG approval. So we'll check in the field. It's just routine.
They bounced and crunched onward for several minutes in silence. They still did not see a camp.
Huh, Bolden said. Maybe he moved it.
What type of research is he doing? Kenner said.
I'm not sure, Bolden said. But I heard he's studying the mechanics of ice calving. You know, how the ice flows to the edge and then breaks off the shelf? Brewster's been planting GPS units in the ice to record how it moves toward the sea.
Are we close to the sea? Evans said.
About 10 or 11 miles away, Bolden said. To the north.
Sarah said, if he's studying iceberg formation, why is he working so far from the coast?
Actually, this isn't so far, Kenner said. 2 years ago, an iceberg broke off the Ross Shelf that was 4 miles wide and 40 miles long. It was as big as Rhode Island, one of the biggest ever seen.
Not because of global warming, though, Evans said to Sarah, with a disgusted snort. Global warming couldn't be responsible for that, oh no.
Actually, it wasn't responsible, Kenner said. It was caused by local conditions.
Evans sighed. Why am I not surprised?
Kenner said, there's nothing wrong with the idea of local conditions, Peter. This is a continent. It would be surprising if it didn't have its own distinctive weather patterns, irrespective of global trends that may or may not exist.
And that's very true, Bolden said. There are definitely local patterns here. Like the katabatic winds.
The what?
Katabatic winds. They're gravitational winds. You've probably noticed that it's a lot windier here than in the interior. The interior of the continent is relatively calm.
What's a gravitational wind? Evans said.
Antarctica's basically one big ice dome, Bolden said. The interior is higher than the coast, and colder. Cold air flows downhill and gathers speed as it goes. It can be blowing 50, 80 miles an hour when it reaches the coast. Today is not a bad day, though.
That's a relief, Evans said.
And then Bolden said, See there, dead ahead. That's Professor Brewster's research camp.
Brewster Camp, Wednesday, October 6th, 2:04 p.m. It wasn't much to look at. A pair of orange-domed tents, one small, one large, flapping in the wind. It looked like the large one was for equipment. They could see the edges of boxes pressing against the tent fabric. From the camp, Evans could see orange-flagged units stuck into the ice every few hundred yards, in a line stretching away into the distance.
"We'll stop now," Bolden said. "I'm afraid Dr. Brewster's not here at the moment. His snow track is gone."
"I'll just have a look," Kenner said.
They shut the engines and climbed out. Evans had thought it was chilly in the cab, but it was a shock to feel the cold air hit him as he stepped out onto the ice. He gasped and coughed. Kenner appeared to have no reaction. He went straight for the supply tent and disappeared inside. Bolden pointed down the line of flags.
"You see his vehicle tracks there, parallel to the sensor units? Dr. Brewster must have gone out to check his line. It runs almost 100 miles to the west."
Sarah said, 100 miles?
"That's right. He has installed GPS radio units all along that distance. They transmit back to him, and he records how they move with the ice."
"But there wouldn't be much movement."
"Not in the course of a few days, no. But these sensors will remain in place for a year or more, sending back the data by radio to Waddell."
"Dr. Brewster is staying that long?"
"Oh, no, he'll go back, I'm sure. It's too expensive to keep him here. His grant allows an initial 21-day stay only. And then it's monitoring visits of a week every few months. But we'll be forwarding his data to him. Actually, we just put it up on the internet. He takes it wherever he happens to be."
"So you assign him a secure web page?"
"Exactly."
Evan stamped his feet in the cold.
"So is Brewster coming back or what?"
"Should be coming back, but I couldn't tell you when."
From within the tent, Kenner shouted, "Evans!"
"I guess he wants me."
Evans went to the tent. Bolden said to Sarah,
"Go ahead with him if you want to."
He pointed off to the south, where clouds were darkening.
"We don't want to be staying here too long. Looks like weather coming up. We have 2 hours ahead of us, and it won't be any fun if it socks in. Visibility drops to 10 feet. Or less. We'd have to stay put until it cleared, and that might be 2 or 3 days.
"I'll tell them," she said. Evans pushed the tent flap aside. The interior glowed orange from the fabric. There were the remains of wooden crates, broken down and stacked on the ground. On top of them were dozens of cardboard boxes, all stenciled identically. They each had the University of Michigan logo, and then green lettering, University of Michigan, Department of Environmental Science, Contents, Research Materials. Extremely sensitive, handle with care, this side up.
"Looks official," Evans was saying.
"You sure this guy isn't an actual research scientist?"
"See for yourself,"
Kenner said, opening one cardboard carton. Within it, Evans saw a stack of plastic cones, roughly the size of highway cones. Except they were black, not orange.
"You know what these are?"
"No." Evan shook his head. Sarah came into the tent. Bolden says bad weather coming, and we shouldn't stay here.
Don't worry, we won't, Kenner said. Sarah, I need you to go into the other tent. See if you can find a computer there. Any kind of computer. Laptop, lab controller, PDA, anything with a microprocessor in it. And see if you can find any radio equipment.
You mean transmitters or radios for listening?
Anything with an antenna.
Okay. She turned and went outside. Evans was still going through the cartons. He opened three, then a fourth. They all contained the same black cones. I don't get it.
Kenner took one cone, turned it to the light. In raised lettering, it said Unit PTBC-XX-904/8776-AW203 U.S. DOD.
Evans said, these are military?
Correct, Kenner said.
But what are they?
They're the protective containers for coned PTBs.
PTBs?
Precision-timed blasts. They're explosives detonated with millisecond timing by computer in order to induce resonant effects. The individual blasts are not particularly destructive, but the timing sets up standing waves in the surrounding material. That's where the destructive power comes from, the standing wave.
What's a standing wave? Evans said.
You ever watch girls play jump rope?
Yes.
Well, if instead of spinning the rope, they shake it up and down, they generate loopy waves that travel along the length of the rope, back and forth.
Okay.
But if the girls shake it just right, the waves appear to stop moving back and forth. The rope takes on a single curved shape and holds it. You've seen that? Well, that's a standing wave. It reflects back and forth in perfect synchronization, so it doesn't seem to move.
And these explosives do that?
Yes. In nature, standing waves are incredibly powerful. They can shake a suspension bridge to pieces. They can shatter a skyscraper. The most destructive effects of earthquakes are caused by standing waves generated in the crust.
So Brewster's got these explosives set in a row. For 100 miles? Isn't that what Bolden said? 100 miles?
Right. And I think there's no question what he intends. Our friend Brewster is hoping to fracture the ice for 100 miles and break off the biggest iceberg in the history of the planet.
Sarah stuck her head in. Kenner said,
did you find a computer?
No, she said. There's nothing there. Nothing at all. No sleeping bag, no food, no personal effects. Nothing but a bare tent. The guy's gone.
Kenner swore. All right, he said. Now listen carefully. Here's what we are going to do.
To Waddell Station, Wednesday, October 6th, 2:22 p.m.
Oh, no, Jimmy Bolden said, shaking his head. I'm sorry. But I can't allow that, Dr. Kenner. It's too dangerous.
Why is it dangerous? Kenner said. You take these two back to the station, and I'll follow Brewster's snow tracks until I meet up with him.
No, sir. We all stay together, sir.
Jimmy, Kenner said firmly, we're not going to do that.
With all due respect, sir, you don't know your way around this part of the world.
You forget. I am an IADG inspector, Kenner said. I was resident in Vostok Station for 6 months in the winter of 99. And I was resident in Morval for 3 months in 91. I know exactly what I'm doing.
Gee, I don't know.
Call back to Waddell. The station chief will confirm it.
Well, sir, if you put it that way...
I do, Kenner said firmly. Now get these two people back to base. Time is wasting.
Okay. If you'll be all right.
Bolden turned to Evans and Sarah.
Then I guess we go. Mount up, folks, and we'll head out.
Within minutes, Evans and Sarah were jouncing along on the ice, following behind Bolden's snow track. Behind them, Kenner was driving parallel to the line of flags, heading east.
Evans looked back just in time to see Kenner stop, get out, check one of the flags briefly, then get back in again and drive on.
Bolden saw it too.
"What is he doing?"
he said in an anxious tone.
"Just looking at the unit, I guess."
"He shouldn't be getting out of his vehicle," Bolden said. "And he shouldn't be alone on the shelf. It's against regulations."
Sarah had the feeling Bolden was about to turn back. She said, "I can tell you something about Dr. Kenner, Jimmy."
"What's that?"
"You don't want to make him mad."
"Really?"
"No, Jimmy, you don't."
"Well, okay then."
They drove on, climbing a long rise, descending on the other side. Brewster's camp was gone, and so was Kenner's snow track. Ahead lay the vast white field of the Ross ice shelf, stretching away to the gray horizon.
2 hours, folks," Bolden said, "and then a hot shower."
The first hour passed uneventfully. Evan started to fall asleep, only to be jolted awake by the sharp movements of the vehicle. Then he would drift off again, his head nodding until the next shock. Sarah was driving. He said to her,
"Aren't you tired?"
"No, not at all," she said. The sun was now low on the horizon and obscured by fog. The landscape was shades of pale gray, with almost no separation between land and sky. Evans yawned.
"Want me to take over?"
"I've got it. Thanks. I'm a good driver."
"I know you are."
He was thinking she had a definite bossy side, despite her charm and her beauty. She was the kind of woman who would want to control the remote.
"I bet you want the remote," he said.
"You think so?" She smiled. It was irritating in a certain way, he thought, that she did not take him seriously as a man. At least, not as a man she could be interested in. In truth, she was a little too cool for his taste, a little too ice blonde, a little too controlled beneath that beautiful exterior. The radio clicked. Bolden said,
"I don't like this weather coming in. We better take a shortcut."
"What shortcut?"
"It's only a half a mile, but it'll save 20 minutes on our time. Follow me."
He turned his snow track left, leaving the packed snow road and heading off onto the ice fields.
"Okay," Sarah said. "Right behind you." "Good work," Bolden said. "We're still an hour from Waddell. I know this route. It's a piece of cake. Just stay directly behind me. Not to the right or left, but directly behind, you understand?"
"Got it," Sarah said.
"Good."
In a matter of minutes, they had moved several hundred yards from the road. The ice there was bare and hard, the treads of the snow tracks scratching and squeaking as they crossed it.
"You're on ice now," Bolden said.
"I noticed."
"Won't be long now."
Evans was looking out the window. He could no longer see the road. In fact, he wasn't sure anymore in which direction it lay. Everything now looked the same. He felt anxious suddenly. "We're really in the middle of nowhere." The snow track slid laterally a little across the ice. He grabbed for the dashboard. Sarah immediately brought the vehicle back under control.
"Jeez," Evans said, clinging to the dashboard.
"Are you a nervous passenger?" she said. "Maybe a little. Too bad we can't get some music."
"Is there any way to get music?" she asked Bolden.
"You should," Bolden said.
"Waddell broadcasts 24 hours. Just a minute."
He stopped his snow track and walked back to their stopped vehicle. He climbed up on the tread and opened the door in a blast of freezing air.
"Sometimes you get interference from this," he said,
and unclipped the transponder from the dash.
"Okay, try your radio now."
Sarah fiddled with the receiver, twisting the knob. Bolden walked back to his red cab, carrying the transponder. His diesel engine spit a cloud of black exhaust as he put the snow track in gear.
You think they'd be a little more ecologically minded, Evans said, looking at the exhaust as Bolden's snow track chugged forward.
I'm not getting any music, Sarah said.
Never mind, Evans said. I don't care that much. They drove another 100 yards. Then Bolden stopped again.
Now what? Evans said.
Bolden climbed out of his vehicle, walked to the back of it, and looked at his own treads. Sarah was still fiddling with the radio, punching the buttons for the different transmission frequencies. She got bursts of static for each.
I'm not sure this is an improvement, Evans said.
Just let it go.
Why have we stopped anyway?
I don't know, Sarah said. He seems to be checking something.
Now Bolden turned and looked back at them.
He didn't move. He just stood there and stared.
Should we get out? Evans said.
The radio crackled and they heard, Is Waddell CM2? 401. Are you there, Dr. Kenner? Waddell CM2. Kenner, can you hear?
Hey, Sarah said, smiling. I think we finally got something.
The radio hissed and sputtered.
Just found Jimmy Bolden unconscious in maintenance room. We don't know who is out there with, but it's not...
Oh, shit, Evans said, staring at the man in front of them. That guy's not Bolden. Who is he?
I don't know, but he's blocking the way, Sarah said, and he's waiting.
Waiting for what? There was a loud crack from beneath them. Inside the cab, the sound echoed like a gunshot. Their vehicle shifted slightly.
Screw this, Sarah said. We're getting out of here, even if I have to ram the bastard.
She put the snow track in gear and started to back away from the vehicle in front of them. She shifted, starting the snow track forward again.
Another crack.
Let's go, Evans said. Let's go!
Crack, crack.
Their vehicle lurched beneath them, tilted sideways at an angle. Evans looked out at the guy pretending to be Bolden.
It's the ice, Sarah said. He's waiting for our weight to break through.
Ram him, Evans said, pointing ahead. The bastard was making some hand gesture to them. It took him a moment for Evans to understand what it meant. Then he got it. The man was waving goodbye. Sarah stomped on the accelerator, and the engine rumbled forward. But in the next moment, the ground gave way completely beneath them, and their vehicle nosed down. Evans saw the blue ice wall of a crevasse. Then the vehicle began to tumble forward, and they were encased for an instant in a world of eerie blue before they plunged onward into the blackness below. Shear Zone, Wednesday, October 6th, 3:51 p.m. Sarah opened her eyes and saw a huge blue starburst, streaks radiating outward in all directions. Her forehead was icy cold, and she had terrible pain in her neck. Tentatively, she shifted her body, checking each of her limbs. They hurt, but she could move all of them except her right leg, which was pinned under something. She coughed and paused, taking stock. She was lying on her side, her face shoved up against the windshield, which she had shattered with her forehead. Her eyes were just inches from the fractured glass. She eased away and slowly looked around. It was dark, a kind of twilight. Faint light coming from somewhere to her left. But she could see that the whole cab of the snow track was lying on its side, the treads up against the ice wall. They must have landed on a ledge of some kind. She looked upward. The mouth of the crevasse was surprisingly close, maybe 30 or 40 yards above her. It was near enough to give her a burst of encouragement. Next she looked down, trying to see Evans. But it was dark everywhere beneath her. She couldn't see him at all. Her eyes slowly adjusted. She gasped. She saw her true situation. There was no ledge. The snow track had tumbled into the narrowing crevasse and wedged itself sideways within the crevasse walls. The treads were against one wall, the roof of the cab against the other, and the cab itself was suspended over the inky downward gash. The door on Evans's side hung open. Evans was not in the cab. He had fallen out, into the blackness.
Peter?
No answer.
Peter, can you hear me?
She listened. There was nothing. No sound or movement. Nothing at all. And then the realization hit her. She was alone down there. 100 feet down in a freezing crevasse in the middle of a trackless ice field, far off the road, miles from anywhere. And she realized, with a chill, that this was going to be her tomb. Bolden, or whoever he was, had planned it very well, Sarah thought. He had taken their transponder. He could drive a few miles, drop it down the deepest crevasse he could find, and then go back to the base. When the rescue party set out, they would head for the transponder. It would be nowhere near where she was. The party might search for days in a deep crevasse before giving up. And if they widened the search, they still wouldn't find the snow track. Even though it was only about 40 yards below the surface, it might as well be 400 yards below. It was too deep to be seen by a passing helicopter, or even a vehicle as it drove by. Not that any vehicle would. They would think the snow track had gone off the marked road, and they would search along the edge of the road. Not way out here, in the middle of the ice field. The road was 17 miles long. They would spend days searching. No, Sarah thought. They would never find her. And even if she could get herself to the surface, what then? She had no compass, no map, no GPS, no radio. It lay smashed beneath her knee. She didn't even know in what direction Waddell Station might be from her present location. Of course, she thought, she had a bright red parka that would be visible from a distance. And she had supplies, food, equipment, all the equipment that guy had talked about before they set out. What was it exactly? She vaguely remembered something about climbing supplies, crampons, and ropes. Sarah bent down, managed to free herself from a toolbox that had pinned her foot to the floor, and then crawled to the rear of the cab, balancing carefully to avoid the gaping, wide-open door beneath her. In the perpetual twilight of the crevasse, she saw the supply locker. It was crumpled slightly from the impact, and she couldn't get it open. She went back to the toolbox, opened it, took out a hammer and a screwdriver, and spent the better part of the next half hour trying to pry the locker open. At last, with a metallic screech, the door swung wide. She peered inside. The locker was empty. No food, no water, no climbing supplies, no space blankets, no heaters. Nothing at all. She took a deep breath, let it out slowly. She remained calm, refusing to panic. She considered her options. Without ropes and crampons, she could not get to the surface. What could she use instead? She had a toolbox. Could she use the screwdriver as an ice axe? Probably too small. Perhaps she could disassemble the gear shift and make an ice axe out of the parts. Or perhaps she could take apart some of the tread and find parts to use. She had no crampons. But if she could find sharp pointed things, screws or something like that, she could push them through the soles of her boots and then climb. And for a rope? Some sort of cloth, perhaps. She looked around the interior. Maybe she could tear the fabric off the seats, or cut it off in strips. That might work. In this way, she kept her spirits up. She kept herself moving forward. Even if her chance of success was small, there was still a chance. A chance! She focused on that.
Where was Kenner? What would he do when he heard the radio message? He probably had already. Would he come back to Waddell? Almost certainly. And he would look for that guy, the one they thought of as Bolden. But Sarah was pretty sure that guy had disappeared. And with his disappearance, her hopes for rescue.
The crystal of her watch was smashed. She didn't know how long she had been down there, but she noticed that it was darker than before. The gap above her was not as bright. Either the weather on the surface was changing, or the sun was low on the horizon. That would mean she had been down there for 2 or 3 hours already. She was aware of a stiffening in her body, not just from the fall, but also she realized because she was cold. The cab had lost its heat. It occurred to her that perhaps she could start the motor and get heat going. It was worth a try. She flicked on the headlights, and one of them worked, glaring off the ice wall, so there was still electricity from the battery. She turned the key. The generator made a grinding noise. The engine did not kick on. And she heard a voice yell, "Hey!" She looked up, toward the surface. She saw nothing but the gap and the strip of gray sky beyond. "Hey!" She squinted. Was somebody really up there? She yelled back, "Hey, I'm down here!" "I know where you are," the voice said. And then she realized the voice was coming from below her. She looked down into the depths of the crevasse. "Peter?" she said. "I'm fucking freezing," he said. His voice floated up from the darkness. "Are you hurt?"
"No, I don't think so. I don't know. I can't move. I'm wedged in some kind of cleft or something."
"How far down are you?"
"I don't know. I can't turn my head to look up. I'm stuck, Sarah."
His voice trembled. He sounded frightened. "Can you move at all?" she said.
"Just one arm."
"Can you see anything?"
"Ice. I see a blue wall. It's about 2 feet away."
Sarah was straddling the open door, peering down into the crevasse, straining to see. It was very dark down there. But it seemed as if the crevasse narrowed quickly farther down. If so, he might not be that far beneath her.
"Peter, move your arm. Can you move your arm?"
"Yes."
"Wave it." "I am."
She didn't see anything. Just darkness. "Okay," she said. "Stop.
Did you see me?"
"No."
"Shit!" he coughed. "It's really cold, Sarah."
"I know. Hang on." She had to find a way to see down into the cleft. She looked under the dashboard, near where the fire extinguisher was clipped to the car wall. If there was a fire extinguisher, there was probably a flashlight there, too. They would be sure to have a flashlight. Someplace. Not under the dashboard. Maybe the glove compartment. She opened it, shoved her hand in, feeling in the darkness. Crunching paper. Her fingers closed around a thick cylinder. She brought it out. It was a flashlight. She flicked it on. It worked. She shone it down into the depths of the crevasse.
"I see that," Peter said. "I see the light."
"Good," she said. "Now swing your arm again."
"I am."
"Now?
I'm doing it now."
She stared.
"Peter, I don't see—"
"Wait a minute." She did see him, just the tips of his fingers in the red gloves, protruding briefly beyond the tractor treads and the ice below. "Peter!"
"What?"
"You're very near me," she said, "just 5 or 6 feet below me."
"Great! Can you get me out?"
"I could if I had a rope."
"There's no rope,"
he said.
"No, I opened the supply chest. There's nothing at all." "But it's not in the supply chest," he said. "It's under the seat."
"What?"
"Yeah, I saw it.
The ropes and stuff are under the passenger seat.
She looked. The seat was on a steel base anchored firmly to the floor of the snow track. There was no doors or compartments in the base. It was difficult to maneuver around the seat to see, but she was sure. No doors. On a sudden impulse, she lifted up the seat cushion and saw a compartment beneath it. The light of her flashlight revealed ropes, hooks, snow axes, crampons. "Got it," she said. "You were right. It's all here." "Whew," he said. She brought the equipment out carefully, making sure none of it fell through the open door. Already her fingers were growing numb, and she felt clumsy as she held a 50-foot length of nylon rope with a 3-pronged ice hook at one end. "Peter," she said, "if I lower a rope, can you grab it?"
"Maybe. I think so."
"Can you hold the rope tight so I can pull you out?"
"I don't know. I just have the one arm free. The other one's pinned under me."
"Are you strong enough to hold the rope with one arm?"
"I don't know. I don't think so. I mean, if I got my body part way out and lost my grip."
His voice broke off. He sounded on the verge of tears. "Okay," she said. "Don't worry.
I'm trapped, Sarah."
"No, you're not."
"I am. I'm trapped. I'm fucking trapped."
Now there was panic.
"I'm gonna die here."
"Peter, stop." She was coiling the rope around her waist as she spoke. "It's going to be all right. I have a plan."
"What plan?"
"I'm going to lower an ice hook on the rope," she said. "Can you hook it on to something, like your belt?"
"Not my belt. No, I'm wedged in here. Sarah, I can't move. I can't reach my belt."
She was trying to visualize his situation. He must be wedged in some sort of cleft in the ice. It was frightening just to imagine it. No wonder he was scared. "Peter," she said, "can you hook it on to anything?"
"I'll try."
"Okay, here it comes," she said, lowering the rope. The hook disappeared into the darkness. "Do you see it?"
"I see it."
"Can you reach it?"
"No."
"Okay, I'll swing it toward you." She turned her wrist gently, starting the rope in a lateral swing. The hook vanished out of sight, then swung back, then out of sight again.
"I can't. Keep doing it, Sarah."
"I am."
"I can't get it, Sarah."
"Keep trying.
It has to be lower."
"Okay, how much lower?"
"About a foot."
"Okay." She lowered it a foot. "How's that?"
"Good. Now swing it."
She did. She heard him grunting, but each time the hook swung back into view.
"I can't do it, Sarah."
"Yes, you can. Keep trying."
"I can't. My fingers are too cold."
"Keep trying," she said. "Here it is again."
"I can't, Sarah. I can't."
"Hey!"
"What?"
"I almost got it." Looking down, she saw the hook spinning when it came back into view. He'd touched it. "Once more," she said. "You'll do it, Peter."
"I'm trying. It's just I have so little."
"I got it, Sarah. I got it." She gave a long sigh of relief. He was coughing in the darkness. She waited. "Okay," he said. "I got it hooked on my jacket."
"Where?"
"Right on the front, just on my chest." She was visualizing that if the hook ripped free, it would tear right into his chin. "No, Peter. Hook it on the armpit."
"I can't unless you pull me out a couple feet."
"Okay. Say when." He coughed.
"Listen, Sarah, are you strong enough to pull me out?"
She had avoided thinking about that. She just assumed that somehow she could. Of course, she didn't know how hard he was wedged in, but...
"Yes," she said, "I can do it." "Are you sure? I weigh 160.
He coughed again.
"Maybe a little more. Maybe 10 more. I've got you tied off on the steering wheel." "Okay, but..."
Don't drop me!
I won't drop you, Peter. There was a pause.
How much do you weigh?
Peter, you never ask a lady that question, especially in L.A.
We're not in L.A.
I don't know how much I weigh, she said. Of course, she knew exactly. She weighed 137 pounds. He weighed over 30 pounds more than that. But I know I can pull you up, she said. Are you ready?
Shit.
Peter, are you ready or not?
Yeah, go!
She drew the rope tight, then crouched down, planting her feet firmly on either side of the open door. She felt like a sumo wrestler at the start of a match, but she knew her legs were much stronger than her arms. This was the only way she could do it. She took a deep breath. Ready? She said.
I guess.
Sarah began to stand upright, her legs burning with effort. The rope stretched taut, then moved upward, slowly at first, just a few inches, but it was moving. It was moving.
Okay, stop! Stop!
What?
Stop!
Okay. She was in mid-crouch. But I can't hold this for long.
Don't hold it at all. Let it out. Slowly. About 3 feet.
She realized that she must have already pulled him part of the way out of the cleft. His voice sounded better, much less frightened, though he was coughing almost continuously.
Peter? Minute! I'm hooking it on my belt!
Okay.
I can see up now, he said. I can see the tread. The tread is about 6 feet above my head.
Okay.
But when you pull me up, the rope's gonna rub on the edge of the tread.
It'll be okay, she said.
And I'll be hanging right over the,
I won't let you go, Peter. He coughed for a while. She waited. He said,
tell me when you're ready.
I'm ready.
Then let's get this over with, he said, before I get scared.
There was only one bad moment. She had pulled him up about 4 feet, and he came free of the cleft, and she suddenly took the full weight of his body. It shocked her. The rope slid 3 feet down. He howled,
Sarah!
She gripped the rope, stopped it.
Sorry! Fuck!
Sorry! She adjusted the added weight, started pulling again. She was groaning with the effort, but it was not long before she saw his hand appear above the tread. And he gripped it and began to haul himself over. Then two hands, and his head appeared. That shocked her. His face was covered in thick blood, his hair matted red. But he was smiling.
Keep pulling, sister.
I am, Peter. I am. Only after he finally had scrambled into the cab did Sarah sink to the floor. Her legs began to shake violently. Her body trembled all over. Evans, lying on his side, coughing and wheezing beside her, hardly noticed. Eventually, the trembling passed. She found the first aid kit and began to clean his face up.
It's only a superficial cut, she said, but you'll need stitches.
If we ever get out of here.
We'll get out, all right.
I'm glad you're confident.
He looked out the window at the ice above.
You done much ice climbing?
She shook her head. But I've done plenty of rock climbing. How different can it be?
More slippery?
And what happens when we get up there? He said.
I don't know.
We have no idea where to go.
We'll follow the guy's snow tracks.
If they're still there. If they haven't blown away. And you know it's at least 7 or 8 miles to Waddell.
Peter,
if a storm comes up, maybe we're better off down here.
I'm not staying here, she said. If I'm going to die, I'll die in daylight.
The actual climb up the crevasse wall was not so bad, once Sarah got used to the way she had to kick her boots with the crampons, and how hard she had to swing the axe to make it bite into the ice. It took her only 7 or 8 minutes to cover the distance and clamber onto the surface. The surface looked exactly the same as before. The same dim sunlight, the same gray horizon that blended with the ground,
the same gray, featureless world. She helped Evans up. His cut was bleeding again, and his mask was red, frozen stiff against his face.
"Shit, it's cold," he said. "Which way do you think?"
Sarah was looking at the sun. It was low on the horizon. But was it sinking or rising? And which direction did the sun indicate anyway when you were at the South Pole? She frowned. She couldn't work it out, and she didn't dare make a mistake.
"We'll follow the tracks," she said at last.
She took off her crampons and started walking. She had to admit, Peter was right about one thing. It was much colder here on the surface. After half an hour, the wind came up, blowing strongly. They had to lean into it as they trudged forward. Worse, the snow began to blow across the ground beneath their feet, which meant,
"We're losing the tracks," Evans said.
"I know.
They're getting blown away. I know."
Sometimes he was such a baby.
What did he expect her to do about the wind?
"What do we do?" he said.
"I don't know, Peter. I've never been lost in Antarctica before."
"Well, me neither." They trudged onward.
"But it was your idea to come up here."
"Peter, pull yourself together."
"Pull myself together? It's fucking freezing, Sarah. I can't feel my nose or my ears or my fingers or my toes."
"Peter!" She grabbed him by the shoulders and shook him.
"Shut up!"
He was silent. Through slots in his face mask, he stared out at her. His eyelashes were white with ice.
"I can't feel my nose either," Sarah said. "We have to keep a grip."
She looked around, turning a full circle, trying to conceal her own growing desperation. The wind was blowing more snow now. It was becoming harder to see. The world was flatter and grayer, with almost no sense of depth. If this weather continued, they would soon not be able to see the ground well enough to avoid the crevasses. Then they would have to stop where they were, in the middle of nowhere. He said,
"You're beautiful when you're angry. You know that?"
"Peter, for Christ's sake."
"Well, you are."
She started walking, looking down at the ground, trying to see the tread marks.
"Come on, Peter."
Perhaps the tracks would return soon to the road. If they did, the road would be easier to follow in a storm, and safer for walking.
"I think I'm falling in love, Sarah."
"Peter,
I had to tell you. This may be my last chance."
He started coughing again.
"Save your breath, Peter. Fucking freezing."
They stumbled on, no longer speaking. The wind howled. Sarah's parka was pressed flat against her body. It became harder and harder to move forward, but she pressed on. She did not know how much longer she continued in that way before she raised a hand and stopped. Evans must not have been able to see her because he walked into her back, grunted, and stopped. They had to put their heads together and shout to each other above the wind.
"We have to stop,"
she yelled.
"I know."
And then, because she didn't know what else to do, she sat down on the ground and pulled her legs up and lowered her head to her knees and tried not to cry. The wind grew louder and louder. Now it was shrieking. The air was thick with flying snow. Evans sat down beside her.
"We're going to fucking die,"
he said. Shear Zone, Wednesday, October 6th, 5:02 p.m. She started shivering. Little tremulous bursts at first, and then almost continuously. She felt as if she were having a seizure. From skiing, she knew what that meant. Her core temperature had dropped dangerously, and the shivering was an automatic physiological attempt to warm her body up. Her teeth chattered. It was hard to speak, but her mind was still working, still looking for a way out.
Isn't there a way to build a snow house?
Evans said something. The wind whipped his words away.
Do you know how? She said.
He didn't answer her. But it was too late anyway, she thought. She was losing control of her body. She could hardly keep her arms wrapped around her knees. The shaking was so bad. And she was starting to feel sleepy.
She looked over at Evans. He was laying on his side on the ice.
She nudged him to get up. She kicked him. He didn't move. She wanted to yell at him, but she couldn't, because her teeth were chattering so badly.
Sarah fought to retain consciousness,
but the desire to sleep was becoming overpowering. She struggled to keep her eyes open, and to her astonishment, began to see swift scenes from her life. Her childhood, her mother, her kindergarten class, ballet lessons, the high school prom. Her whole life was passing before her, just like the book said happened, right before you died. And when she looked up, she saw a light in the distance, just like they said happened. A light at the end of a long, dark tunnel. She couldn't fight it any longer. She lay down. She couldn't feel the ground anyway. She was lost in her own private world of pain and exhaustion. And the light before her was growing brighter and brighter. And now there were two other lights, blinking yellow and green.
Yellow and green?
She fought the sleepiness. She tried to push herself upright again, but she couldn't. Her muscles were too weak, her arms blocks of frozen ice. She couldn't move. Yellow and green lights growing larger. And a white light in the center, very white, like halogen.
She was starting to see details through the swirling snow. There was a silver dome, and wheels, and large glowing letters. The letters said, NASA. She coughed. The thing emerged from the snow. It was some kind of small vehicle, about 3 feet high, no larger than those Sunday lawnmowers that people drove around on. It had big wheels and a flattened dome, and it was beeping as it came directly toward her. In fact, it was going to drive right over her. She realized it without concern. She could do nothing to prevent it. She lay on the ground, dazed, indifferent. The wheels grew larger and larger. The last thing she remembered was a mechanical voice saying, "Hello, hello, please move out of the way. Thank you very much for your cooperation. Hello, hello, please move out of the way." And then nothing.
Waddell Station, Wednesday, October 6th, 8:22 p.m. Darkness, pain, harsh voices, pain. Rubbing all over her body, arms and legs, like fire rubbed on her body. She groaned. A voice spoke, rasping and distant. It sounded like coffee grounds. The rubbing continued, brisk and harsh and excruciating, and a sound like sandpaper, scratching, rough, terrible. Something struck her in the face, on the mouth. She licked her lips. It was snow, freezing snow.
"Got in yet?" a voice said. "Not Ely."
It was a foreign language, Chinese or something. Sarah heard several voices now. She tried to open her eyes, but could not. Her eyes were held shut by something heavy over her face, like a mask or... She tried to reach up, but couldn't. All her limbs were held down, and the rubbing continued. Rubbing, rubbing. She groaned. She tried to speak.
"Thin song now, hoar nod? Don thin song. Ki pub yar work?"
Pain. They rubbed her, whoever they were, while she lay immobilized in darkness. and gradually more sensation returned to her limbs and to her face. She was not glad for it. The pain grew worse and worse. She felt as if she were burned everywhere on her body. The voices seemed to float around her, disembodied. There were more of them now. 4, 5? She was not sure anymore. All women, it sounded like. And now they were doing something else, she realized. Violating her. Sticking something in her body. Dull and cold. Not painful. Cold. The voices floated, slithered all around her. At her head, at her feet, touching her roughly. It was a dream. Or death. Maybe she was dead, she thought. She felt oddly detached about it. The pain made her detached. And then she heard a woman's voice in her ear, very close to her ear, and very distinct. The woman said, "Sarah." She moved her mouth. "Sarah, are you awake?" She nodded slightly. "I'm going to take the ice pack off your face, all right?" She nodded. The weight, the mask was lifted. "Open your eyes. Slowly." She did. She was in a dimly lit room with white walls, a monitor to one side, a tangle of green lines. It was like a hospital room. A woman looked down at her with concern. The woman wore a white nurse's uniform and a down vest. The room was cold. Sarah could see her breath. She said, "Don't try to speak." Sarah didn't. "You're dehydrated. It'll be a few hours yet. We're bringing your temperature up slowly." "You're very lucky, Sarah. You're not going to lose anything." Not lose anything? She felt alarmed. Her mouth moved. Her tongue was dry, thick feeling. A sort of hissing sound came from her throat. "Don't speak," the woman said. "It's too soon." "Is your pain bad?" "Yes." "I'll give you something for it." She raised a syringe. "Your friend saved your life, you know. He managed to get to his feet and open the radio phone on the NASA robot. That's how we knew where to find you." Her lips moved. "He's in the next room. We think he'll be all right, too. Now just rest." She felt something cold in her veins. Her eyes closed. Waddell Station, Thursday, October 7th, 7:34 p.m. The nurses left Peter Evans alone to get dressed. He put on his clothes slowly, taking stock of himself. He was all right, he decided, though his ribs hurt when he breathed. He had a big bruise on the left side of his chest, another big bruise on his thigh, and an ugly purple welt on his shoulder, a line of stitches on his scalp. His whole body was stiff and aching. It was excruciating to put on his socks and shoes. But he was all right. In fact, better than that, he felt new somehow, almost reborn. Out there on the ice, he had been certain he was going to die. How he found the strength to get to his feet, he did not know. He had felt Sarah kicking him, but he did not respond to her. Then he'd heard the beeping sound, and when he looked up, he saw the letters NASA. He realized vaguely that it was some kind of vehicle, so there must be a driver. The front tires had stopped just inches from his body. He managed to get to his knees and haul himself up over the tires, grabbing onto the struts. He hadn't understood why the driver hadn't climbed out and helped him. Finally, he managed to get to his knees in the howling wind. He realized that the vehicle was low and bulbous, barely 4 feet off the ground. It was too small for any human operator. It was some kind of robot. He scraped snow away from the dome-like shell. The lettering read, "NASA Remote Vehicle Meteorite Survey." The vehicle was talking, repeating a taped voice over and over. Evans couldn't understand what it was saying because of the wind. He brushed away the snow, thinking there must be some method of communication, some antenna, some... Then his fingers had touched a panel with a finger hole. He pulled it open. Inside he saw a telephone. A regular telephone handset, bright red. He held it to his frozen mask. He could not hear anything from it, but he said, "Hello." Nothing more. He collapsed again. But the nurses told him what he had done was enough to send a signal to the NASA station at Patriot Hills. NASA had notified Waddell, who sent out a search party, and found them in 10 minutes. They were both still alive. Barely. That had been more than 24 hours ago. It had taken the medical team 12 hours to bring their body temperatures back to normal, because, the nurse said, it had to be done slowly. They told Evans he was going to be fine, but he might lose a couple of his toes. They would have to wait and see. It would be a few days. His feet were bandaged with some kind of protective splints around the toes. He couldn't fit into his regular shoes, but they had found him an oversized pair of sneakers. They looked like they belonged to a basketball player. On Evans, they made huge clown feet. But he could wear them, and there wasn't much pain. Tentatively, he stood. He was tremulous, but he was all right. The nurse came back. "Hungry?" He shook his head. "Not yet." "Pain?" He shook his head. "Just, you know, everywhere." "That'll get worse," she said. She gave him a small bottle of pills. "Take one of these every 4 hours if you need it. And you'll probably need it to sleep for the next few days." "And Sarah?" "Sarah will be another half hour or so." "Where's Kenner?" "I think he's in the computer room." "Which way is that?" She said, "Maybe you better lean on my shoulder." "I'm fine," he said. "Just tell me the way." She pointed, and he started walking. But he was more unsteady than he realized. His muscles weren't working right. He felt shaky all over. He started to fall. The nurse quickly ducked, sliding her shoulder under his arm. "Tell you what," she said, "I'll just show you the way." This time, he did not object. Kenner sat in the computer room with the bearded station chief, McGregor, and Sanyong Tapa. Everybody was looking grim. "We found him," Kenner said, pointing to a computer monitor. "Recognize your friend?" Evans looked at the screen. "Yeah," he said, "that's the bastard." On the screen was a photo of the man Evans knew as Bolden. But the ID form on screen gave his name as David R. Kane, 26 years old, born Minneapolis, B.A. Notre Dame, M.A. University of Michigan, current status Ph.D. candidate in oceanography, University of Michigan, Ann Arbor. Research project, Dynamics of Ross Shelf Flow as Measured by GPS Sensors. Thesis advisor, project supervisor, James Brewster, University of Michigan. "His name's Kane," the Waddell chief said. "He's been here for a week along with Brewster." "Where is he now?" Evans said darkly. "No idea. He didn't come back to the station today. Neither did Brewster. We think they may have gone to McMurdo and hopped the morning transport out. We have a call in to McMurdo to do a vehicle count, but they haven't gotten back to us yet." "You're sure he's not still here?" Evans said. "Quite sure. You need an ID tag to open the exterior doors here, so we always know who's where. Neither Kane nor Brewster opened any doors in the last 12 hours. They aren't here. So you think they may be on the plane?" "McMurdo Tower wasn't sure. They're pretty casual about the daily transport. If somebody wants to go, they just hop on and leave. It's a C-130, so there's always plenty of room. You see, a lot of the research grants don't permit you to leave during the period of your research, but people have birthdays and family events back on the mainland, so they just go and come back. It's unrecorded." "If I recall," Kenner said,
Brewster came here with two graduate students. Where's the other one?
Interesting. He left for McMurdo yesterday, the day you arrived.
So they all got out, Kenner said. Got to give them credit. They're smart.
He looked at his watch.
Now let's see what, if anything, they left behind.
The name on the door said Dave Kane, New Mish. Evans pushed it open and saw a small room, an unmade bed, a small desk with a messy stack of papers, and four cans of Diet Coke. There was a suitcase lying open in the corner.
Let's get started, Kenner said. I'll take the bed and the suitcase. You check the desk.
Evans began to go through the papers on the desk. They all seemed to be reprints of research articles. Some were stamped U-Mish, Geo-Lib, followed by a number.
Window dressing, Kenner said when he was shown the papers. He brought those papers with him. Anything else? Anything personal?
Evans didn't see anything of interest. Some of the papers were highlighted in yellow marker. There was a stack of 3x5 note cards with some notes written on them. But they seemed to be genuine and related to the stack of papers.
You don't suppose this guy is really a graduate student? Could be, though I doubt it. Eco-terrorists aren't usually well-educated.
There were pictures of glacier flows and satellite images of various sorts. Evans shuffled through them quickly. Then he paused at one. What caught his eye was the caption, Scorpion B. Listen, he said. On that list of four locations, wasn't one of them called Scorpion?
Yes.
It's right here in Antarctica, Evans said. Look at this.
Kenner started to say, but it can't be,
and abruptly broke off.
This is extremely interesting, Peter. Well done. It was in that stack. Good. Anything else?
Despite himself, Evans felt pleased by Kenner's approval.
It's the same basic pattern of rock outcrops in the snow, Evans said excitedly. And I don't know about these faint lines. Roads? Rocks covered in snow?
Yes, Kenner said. I think that's almost certainly correct.
And if they're aerial photographs, there must be a way to trace them.
Do you think these numbers are references of some kind?
There's no question.
Kenner pulled out a small pocket magnifying glass and scanned the image, peering closely.
Yes, Peter. Very well done.
Evans beamed.
From the doorway, McGregor said, You found something? Can I help?
I don't think so, Kenner said. We'll deal with this ourselves.
Evans said, But maybe he will reckon.
No, Kenner said. We'll get the ID off the NASA image files. Let's continue.
They searched in silence for several minutes more. Kenner took out a pocket knife and began cutting the lining of the suitcase lying open in the corner of Brewster's office.
Ah.
He straightened. In his fingers, he held two curved arcs of pale rubber. What are those? Evans said. Silicone?
Or something very similar. A kind of soft plastic, at any rate.
Kenner seemed very pleased.
What are they for? Evans said. I have no idea,
Kenner said. He resumed his search of the suitcase. Privately, Evans wondered why Kenner was so pleased. Probably he was not saying what he knew in front of McGregor. But what could two bits of rubber mean anyway? What could they be used for? Evans went through the documents on the desk a second time, but found nothing more. He lifted the desk lamp and looked under the base. He crouched down and looked under the desk in case something was taped there. He found nothing.
Kenner closed the suitcase. As I thought, nothing more. We were very lucky to find what we did.
He turned to McGregor.
Where's Sanyong?
In the server room, doing what you requested. Cutting Brewster and his team out of the system. The server room was hardly larger than a closet. There were twin racks of processors running floor to ceiling and the usual mesh ceiling for cabling. There was a master terminal in the room on a small steel table.
Sanyong was crowded in there, with a Waddell technician at his side, looking frustrated. Kenner and Evans stood outside, in the hallway. Evans was pleased that he felt steady enough to stand. His strength was coming back quickly.
"It hasn't been easy," Sanyong said to Kenner. "The procedure here is to give each Waddell researcher private storage space and also direct radio and internet connections. And these three guys knew how to take advantage of it. Apparently the third man with Brewster was the computer guy. Within a day of his arrival, he got into the system as root and installed backdoors and Trojans all over the place. We're not sure how many. We're trying to get them out."
"He also added a few dummy user accounts," the technician said.
"Like about 20, Sanyong said. "But I'm not worried about those. They're probably just that, dummies. If this guy was smart, and he was, he'd have given himself access to the system through an existing user, so he'd go undetected. We're looking now for any users who have added a new secondary password in the last week. But this system doesn't have a lot of maintenance utilities. It's slow going."
"What about the Trojans?" Kenner said. "How are they timed?"
In computer slang, a Trojan was an innocent-looking program installed in the system. It was designed to wake up at a later time and carry out some action. It derived its name from the way the Greeks won the Trojan War, by making a huge horse and presenting it to the Trojans as a gift. Once the horse was inside the walls of Troy, the Greek soldiers, who had been hiding inside it, came out and attacked the city. The classic Trojan was one installed by a disgruntled employee. It erased all the hard drives in a business 3 months after the employee was fired. But there were many variations.
"Timing on all of the ones I found here is short," Sanyong said. "One day, 2 days from now. We found one that is 3 days from now. Nothing after that."
"So, just as we suspected," Kenner said.
"Exactly," Sanyong said, nodding. "They intended it to happen soon."
"Intended what?"
Evans said. "The calving of the big iceberg," Kenner said.
"Why soon? They would still have been here."
"I'm not sure they would have. But in any case, the timing was determined by something else."
"Yes?"
"What?"
Evans said. Kenner gave him a look. "We can go into it later."
He turned back to Sanyong.
"And what about the radio connects?"
"We disabled all the direct connects right away," he said.
"And I assume you did work on the ground at the location itself."
"I did," Kenner said.
"And what did you do on the ground?"
Evans said. "Random disconnects. Of what? Tell you later."
"So we're redundant,"
Sanyong said. "No, because we can't be sure there's not someone else embedded in this place who will undo our work."
"I wish," Evans said, "I knew what the hell you guys were talking about."
"Later," Kenner said.
This time the look was sharp. Evans was silent. He felt a little wounded. McGregor said, "Ms. Jones is awake and getting dressed."
"All right," Kenner said. "I believe our work here is done. Wheels up in an hour."
"To go where?" Evans said.
"I thought that was obvious," Kenner said. "Helsinki, Finland."
End of CD 6.